welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for today, Monday, December 28. I'm your reader, Ken Lauder. First, let's take a look at the weather for eastern Iowa. Today, we're expecting a partly cloudy day with winds from the west at 5 to 15 miles per hour. And Cedar Rapids will see a high of 27. We'll see 28 in Iowa City, following to a low tonight of 12 in Cedar Rapids and 13 in Iowa City. Sunset tonight is at 4:43 p.m., sunrise tomorrow at 7:34 a.m., for a total daylight period of 9 hours and 9 minutes. And now from the front page of today's Gazette, "During a Pandemic, Libraries Come to You," a story by Kat Russell of the Gazette staff. Like so many other organizations and businesses, the usually bustling Cedar Rapids Public Library has had to get creative in finding ways to keep serving customers during the coronavirus pandemic. Over the past 9 months, we've had to adapt our programming. We've had to shift our customer service from in-person to online, and we've had to find new ways to deliver our services and materials, Library Executive Director Dara Schmidt said. Those new ways include curbside pickup of library materials, personal shopping and surprise grab bags, acquiring and implementing tools to help families whose children are learning from home delivery, then in school, and doorstep delivery. Forced to close as the number of positive COVID-19 cases climbed in the early weeks of the pandemic, the library had to address how to get its hard copy materials into the hands of those who needed them. That's where the curbside pickup started, Schmidt said. It was something that our patrons had wanted for a while now, and we were still figuring out how to implement it. But when the pandemic hit, we had to close, and starting a curbside pickup service became crucial. Ordering materials for curbside service is simple. Just go to the library's webpage on the program at crlibrary.org/curbsideholes. Then fill out a form requesting the materials you want and set a time to pick them up. They will be wrapped in a paper bag and placed on a table in front of the library at the scheduled time. Curbside pickup is offered at both the downtown and Ladd library locations. Since the curbside service began, nearly 5,000 patrons have used the curbside service and more than 130,000 items have been delivered so far during the pandemic, said Amber McNamara, the library's community relations manager. The library also developed and implemented a personal shopping program and started offering grab bags for patrons looking for book recommendations. For the personal shopping program, Schmidt said patrons can go to the library website and fill out a curbside materials request form where they answer a few questions about their reading preferences. Based on the answers, the library staff will select materials they think you would enjoy and leave them at the curbside table at your scheduled pickup time. The grab bags are similar but different, Schmidt said. For the grab bags, maybe you don't have an idea of what type of books you'd like to read, but you have an idea of the genres you like. Again, that person can fill out a form on the website, and library staff will pick out a few books and put together a grab bag that can be picked up curbside. Additionally, Schmidt said the library has started offering delivery services, working with a delivery service called Chomp, the same service the Iowa City Public Library has been using. Schmidt said the patrons in the Cedar Rapids area can go online, order materials, and have them delivered to their door. There's a delivery fee that varies according to distance. We had been thinking about starting up with a delivery service for a while. It seemed like it would be especially utilized during the winter months. And when the pandemic hit, we figured this was the time to get it started. So we rolled out that delivery service a few weeks ago, and it's too early to tell if it will be successful, but it seems like people are really loving it. Schmidt said the Marion and Hiawatha public libraries also have recently started offering delivery through Chomp. And for parents and students who are trying to navigate online schooling, Schmidt said the library, with the help of the Friends of the Library, which provided funding, was able to purchase Help Now, an online homework help resource that features free online tutoring, writing labs, and a collaboration space. More than 1,200 users have accessed this digital resource since its launch in mid-September, McNamara said. So that's just another way that the library has been able to look at the community, look at what people need, and what are the gaps in resources, and try to meet that need, Schmidt said. The library also had to shift its focus from in-person customer service to the promotion of digital products and services, which Schmidt said was perhaps one of the biggest adjustments staff members had to make. Having never done virtual programming before, the library team immediately took programs virtual and saw more than 10,000 views in the first month alone, McNamara said. Those programs include virtual story times for early learners, STEAM or STEAM programs, special performances by musicians and artists, adult education, game nights, and collaborations with local partners. Since the pandemic began in March, McNamara said the library provided more than 350 virtual programs, viewed more than 123,000 times. The library shifted its budget and resources to increase digital materials, McNamara said. Streaming services such as Hoopla, which offers ebooks, audiobooks, TV and movies, and Canopy, which offers movies and TV, saw over 82,000 users through the library since the pandemic began. It's been really amazing to see what we can do and find new ways to work with the community and meet its needs, Schmidt said. And the staff has been amazing. All these changes, they've just run with it, and they're constantly finding ways to streamline or improve what we're doing. Also from today's front page, a story by Lee Hermiston of the Gazette staff entitled GuideLink Center Eyes February Opening. This is from Iowa City. A new Johnson County center intended to improve urgent mental health care and crisis intervention services is days away from completion. Matthew Miller, project manager for the GuideLink Center at 300 Southgate Avenue in Iowa City, said the building is about 95% complete. Substantial completion is expected by January 2, Miller said recently. We could take over the building and do what we need to do to be in there. When the GuideLink Center opens, Miller is hoping for early February, it will be home to sobering and crisis stabilization units, as well as a low-barrier shelter. Police officers and sheriff's deputies have been training in crisis intervention since 2015 to better recognize when someone is having a mental health issue or other crisis. But even with that training, those calls still often result in someone going to jail or the emergency room. The GuideLink Center is planned as a long-sought-after third option. We've worked very hard to find alternatives to arrest, said Iowa City Police Sergeant Andrew McKnight. To have additional resources to avoid incarceration, to avoid trips to the ER, is a good thing. The center is supported by property taxes levied for mental health services, Medicaid funds, and other sources. Linn County is opening a similar center at the site of the former Linn County Public Health Building at 501 13th Street Northwest in Cedar Rapids. Because of the holidays, Miller said it probably will be January 4 or 5 before a final occupancy inspection can be scheduled with the city. From there, Johnson County's information technology team will still need to outfit the building and furniture will need to be installed. Miller said staff working at the GuideLink Center also will need time to walk through workflows and get a feel for the space. GuideLink officials are considering a soft opening while they get used to the building, Miller said. We would just accept drop-offs from law enforcement so we can work through everything and make sure the kinks are worked out, he said. Most of the staff for the GuideLink Center has been hired, with only a few positions left to be filled. Miller said the facility will employ about 40 people from various entities, including the county, Penn Center, Prelude Behavioral Services, and Abbey Health. Everybody will work together as GuideLink employees, Miller said. We want this to appear as we're doing business as GuideLink. We're all one team. Once fully operational, the facility will have a capacity of 38 people, including 10 in the sobering units, 16 in overnight rooms for detoxification or stabilization, and 12 in short-term crisis observation. Miller said he's been meeting with groups at the University of Iowa, the Iowa City Downtown District, Project Better Together, city councils, law enforcement agencies, and others to make sure the word is out about the opening. The feedback has been really positive, he said. McKnight said police are eager to start using the facility. Officers are excited to have this as an additional resource at their disposal, he said. Having them all in the same building is exciting. Turning to today's editorial page, we have a guest column by Rod Sullivan. Mr. Sullivan serves on the Johnson County Board of Supervisors, and his piece today is entitled, State and Cities Are Screwing the Poor. Iowa City wants to push for a local option sales tax as part of its plan to restructure the Iowa City Police Department. So I am left once again to petition my government on behalf of the principle of economic justice. Sales taxes are more regressive than property taxes. What is regressivity? This means that the poor pay a higher percentage of their income in taxes than do the wealthy. Relative to income, the poor pay more than twice what the middle class pay, and nearly five times the amount the wealthy pay. Even with exemptions, sales taxes hit the poor hardest. So who are the poor? There are more poor women than poor men. Over half the children in Iowa are poor. Sales taxes hurt them the most. So who benefits? The biggest property taxpayers in Johnson County will benefit the most. That includes the Coral Ridge Mall, Mid-American, Hawk Landlord LLC, ACT, the Green State Credit Union, and the Graduate Hotel. They benefit the most. Is that really what we want to do? Cut taxes on those businesses and shift the cost to poor kids? We would be literally taking money from people on Social Security and using it to buy down the taxes of those corporations. People like to talk about all the big things we could do with sales tax, but we could do them right now with an increase in the property tax. That is correct. We can do it all with property taxes. Iowa City ranks number 100 in property tax rate among Iowa's cities at $40.77. That's lower than Des Moines, West Des Moines, Cedar Rapids, Davenport, and many other cities. Look at the language being used. The sales tax is, quote, an opportunity we can't pass up, unquote, and, quote, leaving money on the table, end quote. Why isn't a property tax increase viewed as an opportunity we can't pass up? I'll tell you why. Elected officials are afraid to ask the people with money to pay more, so they squeeze the poor, who by and large don't show up at council meetings, and this is just a matter of political will. Another problem with the sales tax is that services used solely by wealthy people tend not to be taxed. The services of accountants, attorneys, advertising, consultants, and stockbrokers are not subject to sales taxes. Some folks are under the impression that renters do not pay property taxes. While it is true they do not pay them directly, renters are definitely covering the landlord's property taxes. Assuming there is a demand, landlords will raise rents, regardless of taxes. Supply and demand drives the rental market, nothing else. One argument sales tax proponents often make is that outsiders will help pay the tax. People who live outside Johnson County will pay about 20 to 25% of the taxes collected. These are, by and large, not people from Chicago, however, but commuters who purchase goods on the way home. I have trouble saying that a person earning $25,000 should pay more tax just because she lives in Williamsburg, Riverside, West Branch, etc., especially when the local wealthy would be let off the hook at her expense. It is important that we think of our middle and low-income neighbors who commute. The Republicans in the Iowa legislature made the sales tax even worse a problem a couple of years ago, and pretty much impossible for me to support. At that time, they required that at least 50% of any sales tax revenue goes toward property tax relief. GOP legislators pretty much could not have been more intentional in screwing the poor. There are several theological arguments against increasing the sales tax. I just happen to buy into a worldview that those who are able need to help those who are not. It is a basic organizing principle of any society. The last shall be first, and the first shall be last. Do unto others. And a rich man has a better chance of putting a camel through the eye of a needle than getting into heaven. Each of these argues against putting a greater tax burden on the poor. Let's follow this lead rather than doing more to comfort the comfortable. Frankly, I'm really tired of wealthy people saying that sales taxes aren't that regressive. Easy for you to say as you vote to cut your own taxes at the expense of our poorest residents. And repeating your false claim over and over does not make it true. This argument is shameful, really. We are just all so scared to ask the people with the most resources to pay for things. And we have a letter to the editor today from Steve Merovitz of Mount Vernon. His letter is entitled, What About Biden Voters? What about the rest of us, you know, the 80 million people who voted for Joe Biden? To think, as Republicans across the country engage in undermining our national election, those Republicans apparently believe that somehow a conspiracy was hatched across a dozen states, some governed by Republicans and others by Democrats, to deny Donald Trump a second term. The people engaged in this lunacy know that Trump has alienated broad swaths of America. He showed he was perfectly capable of driving 80 million Americans to vote against him. We are not chopped liver. We want our votes to count. We demand that our votes count. The Republicans have gone way too far this time. That note by Steve Merovitz of Mount Vernon. And we have a story by John McLaughlin of the Gazette staff entitled Virus Cases Drop on Decreased Testing. As the number of COVID-19 tests analyzed in Iowa over the holiday weekend plummeted, the state reported 619 new cases and confirmed one death due to the virus on Sunday morning. The five Test Iowa drive-through sites, normally closed on weekends, were closed on Christmas Day also. The hiatus resulted in only 1,897 test results being analyzed in the 24-hour period ending at 11 a.m. Sunday, according to data released by the state. Of those tests, nearly 33%, or 619, were positive, and the others were negative or inconclusive. The number of people tested in Iowa on Friday and Saturday was the lowest since late April. Of the new cases Sunday, Linn County added 35, for a total so far of 16,354. Johnson County added 40 cases for a total of 10,830 so far. Iowa public health officials confirmed one new death, a person from Scott County, between the ages of 61 and 80. That additional death brings the total number of people who have died as a result of the infection in Iowa to 3,745. The number of patients being treated in Iowa hospitals for COVID-19 continued to decline. During the 24-hour period, hospitalizations went down from 558 to 553. Those in intensive care declined from 114 to 109, but those on ventilators rose from 63 to 65. According to the state, 30 of Iowa's 99 counties have a 14-day average positivity rate of 15% or above. The 10 Iowa counties that have recorded the most positive COVID-19 cases since the start of the pandemic are first Polk County at 40,490, Linn County at 16,354, Scott County at 13,801, Black Hawk County at 12,521, Woodbury County at 12,071, Johnson County at 10,830, Dubuque County at 10,442, Pottawatomie County at 8,075, Story County at 7,863, and Dallas County at 7,724. You're listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for today, Monday, December 28 on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. And first from Marion, Linda Marie Reichart, age 71, and the loving mother of two, passed away on December 25. A visitation will be held from 3 to 5 p.m. on Thursday, December 31, at the Cedar Memorial Park Chapel of Memories, where a private memorial service will follow at 5 p.m. From Cedar Rapids, George Dwayne Aldrich, age 88, died Monday, December 24, at Keystone Cedars. As per George's wishes, there will be no visitation or services. And from Marion, Barbara, also known as Barb May Strait, age 84, of Cedar Rapids, passed away peacefully from Alzheimer's with complications due to COVID-19 on Saturday, December 26, at the Northbrook Manor in Cedar Rapids. A funeral service will be held at 2:30 p.m. Wednesday, December 30, at the Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Marion, where the family will greet friends for 1 hour prior to the service. Burial will follow at the Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery in Cedar Rapids. From Central City, Judith, also known as Judy Jane Colda, age 78, passed away on Thursday, December 24, of natural causes at the Anamosa Care Center in Anamosa. A private funeral mass will be held at St. Stephen's Catholic Church in Central City, and burial will follow at the Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery in Cedar Rapids. The Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service of Central City is assisting the family. From Cedar Rapids, Patrick Welby Logan, age 80, died on Thursday, December 24, at his home. A funeral mass is at 10 a.m. Wednesday, December 30, at St. John the 23rd Catholic Church. A visitation will be for 1 hour before the service at the church, and burial is in the St. Joseph Cemetery in Iowa City. Arrangements are with Stuart Baxter Funeral and Memorial Service in Cedar Rapids. From Cedar Rapids, Jackson Theodore Selk, age 74, passed away peacefully on Friday, December 25, from complications due to COVID-19. A public visitation will be from 1 to 3 p.m. Sunday, December 27, at the Chapel of Memories. A private family service will be held at the Cedar Memorial Chapel of Memories. From Dysart, Ronald Brent Carmichael, age 74, died peacefully at his home on December 23rd. Ron will be remembered and celebrated with a visitation from 4 to 7 p.m. Monday, December 28, at the Dysart United Methodist Church. A family funeral is at 10:30 a.m. Tuesday, December 29, at the United Methodist Church in Dysart. He will then be laid to rest at the Veterans Cemetery in Van Meter. From Centerpoint, Jeanette Elgin, age 87, died on Thursday, December 24th. A visitation will be held from 10 to 11 a.m. Thursday, December 31, at the Murdoch Linwood Funeral Home and Cremation Service at 520 Wilson Avenue Southwest in Cedar Rapids. A funeral service will follow at 11 a.m. Thursday at the funeral home. Burial will take place at Center Point Cemetery. From Center Point, Howard, also known as Ed Hurt, age 86, died Friday, December 25, at his home surrounded by his loving family. A visitation will be from 4 to 7 p.m. Wednesday, December 30, at the Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home. A private family funeral service will be held Thursday, December 31, at the Cedar Memorial Park Chapel of Memories. Burial will follow at the Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery. From Iowa City, Gary A. Schooley, age 73, died on Saturday, December 26, at University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. Funeral services will be held at 10 a.m. Thursday, December 31, at the Gay and Chia Funeral and Cremation Services, with burial to follow at Memory Gardens Cemetery. The services will be live-streamed for friends and extended family. Please share your support and memories with Gary's family and find a link to the live stream details at his live stream link at www.gayandchia.com under obituaries. From Fairfax, Thomas, also known as Tom William Outerman, age 83, died Friday, December 24, 25 at the Dennis and Donna Oldorf House of Mercy after a long and courageous battle with lung cancer. Private services will be held and burial at the St. Joseph Cemetery. A vigil service will be held at 3 p.m. Monday at the Tien Funeral Home, where friends may visit with the family Monday from 3 to 6 p.m. From Tipton, Richard G. Ward, age 90, passed away on Saturday, December 26, at the Mechanicsville Specialty Care Center. Graveside services will be held at 11 a.m. Wednesday, December 30, at the Tipton Masonic Cemetery. The Chapman Funeral Home is caring for Richard and his family. And from Maquoketa, Bobby Albers, a jurist who became the first female chief judge of a judicial district in Iowa state history, died Thursday, December 24, of complications of Alzheimer's at her home in rural Jackson County. Due to COVID-19 concerns, there will be neither a visitation nor memorial service. A private burial will take place, and in 2021, a celebration of Bobby's time on earth will be announced. From Marion, Waldo Morris, age 84, passed away peacefully at his home on Christmas Eve 2020, surrounded by his family after suffering a severe stroke. A private funeral service will be held at the Murdoch Funeral Home in Marion and burial at Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery in Cedar Rapids on Wednesday, December 30. From Cedar Rapids, Patricia L. Kiltz, age 85, passed away December 24 at the Westridge Care Center. Private graveside service will be held at 11 a.m. Wednesday, December 30, at Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery. From Manchester, Charles, also known as Chuck Joseph Lahr, age 73, passed away on Saturday, December 26 at the Sisters of Mercy Hospice House in Hiawatha of military service-related cancer. A private funeral service is at 11 a.m. Wednesday, December 30, at the Leonard Muller Funeral Home in Manchester. A public visitation will be from 3 to 7 p.m. Wednesday, December 29, at the Leonard Muller Funeral Home in Manchester, and interment will be in the Forestville Cemetery in Dundee. From Monticello, Barbara Jones, age 56, formerly of Hopkinton, died on Thursday, December 24, at St. Luke's Hospital in Cedar Rapids from complications of COVID-19. A visitation will be held from 4 to 7 p.m. Tuesday, December 29, at the Getch Funeral Home in Monticello, where private family services will be held on Wednesday. Interment will be in the Hopkinton Cemetery. From Cedar Rapids, Madonna E. Anderson, age 76, of Cedar Rapids, passed away on Thursday, December 24, at the Dennis and Donna Oldorf Hospice House of Mercy in Hiawatha. There will be no memorial services. Cedar Memorial is assisting the family. From Belle Plaine, Craig Allen Schminke Sr., age 65, passed away December 22 at his home. A public graveside service will be at 11:30 a.m. Wednesday, December 30, at the Oak Hill Cemetery in Belle Plaine. The Hrabic Newhouse Funeral Service is assisting the family. From Cedar Rapids, John Jensen, age 88, passed away Saturday, December 26. There will be no visitation or services per John's request. There will be a private family service at a later date. From Iowa City, Claudine Violet, also known as Dee Brown, age 83, a longtime resident and former teacher, died Friday, December 18 at Mercy Hospital. A celebration of life and burial will be held at a later date. From Newall, Pamela Decker Van Etten, age 75, passed away peacefully on Saturday, December 26, at the Dennis and Donna Oldorf Hospice House in Hiawatha. A private family mass of Christian burial will be held at St. Paul's Catholic Church in Newhall. Interment will be held at St. Patrick Cemetery in Winthrop. And in other death notices today, from Atkins, Virginia Roths, age 85, died Saturday, December 26. The Murdoch Linwood Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Cedar Rapids is assisting the family. From Vestina, Ronald Buckheit, age 80, died Friday, December 25. The Schluter Balick Funeral Home in Decorah is assisting the family. From Independence, Jeff Cusick, age 59, died Saturday, December 26. The Fawcett Schmitz Funeral Home in Winthrop is assisting the family. From Maquoketa, Donna Rupp, age 79, died Sunday, December 27. The Carson Celebration of Life Center in Maquoketa is assisting the family. From Maquoketa, Audrey J. Upmeyer, age 92, died Wednesday, December 23rd. The Carson Celebration of Life Center in Maquoketa is helping with arrangements. From Monticello, Ronald, also known as Beans Behrens, age 86, died Thursday, December 24. The Getch Funeral Home in Monticello is assisting the family. From Olwine, Dorothy E. Kunkel, age 90, died Sunday, December 27. The Jameson Schmitz Funeral Home in Olwine is helping with arrangements. From Sigourney, Donna Etter, age 78, died Thursday, December 24. The Powell Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Sigourney is assisting the family. From Waterville, Russell, also known as Rusty D. Rowe, age 52, died Friday, December 25. The Martin Grau Funeral Home in Waukon is assisting the family. And from Waukon, Elizabeth Ellickson, age 73, died Friday, December 25. The Martin Grau Funeral Home in Waukon is assisting the family. From Winthrop, Marvel F. Denny, age 89, died on Sunday, December 27. The Fawcett Schmitz Funeral Home in Winthrop is assisting the family. And in other deaths, Mary Lou Zabel, age 81, of Prairie du Chien, Wisconsin, died on Thursday, December 24th. The Thornburg Grau Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Prairie du Chien, Wisconsin, is assisting the family. And today's paper doesn't have any prep sports, as is very common on Monday. The lead story on the sports page today is about Iowa Hawkeye football, entitled Day the Music Died, a story by Jeff Johnson of the Gazette staff. Just like that, the Iowa football season is over. COVID-19 issues within the Missouri program prompted the cancellation of Wednesday's Music City Bowl in Nashville, Tennessee. It's the 17th canceled bowl game this season. On behalf of our whole team, it's just extremely disappointing to end the season this way, Iowa coach Kirk Ferentz said. This is two games in a row now where we just haven't been able to get to the finish line. That's certainly disappointing. I feel terrible for our players first and foremost. Can't say enough about the group that we've been able to work with this year. It's just been a remarkable group of players, a remarkable group of young people. Iowa finishes 6-2 with six consecutive wins. It made it through the entire regular season unscathed from a game cancellation standpoint, but lost its Big Ten Conference Champions Week game against Michigan because of coronavirus issues with the Wolverines, and now it's bowl game. Missouri Director of Athletics Jim Sterk said his football program would have to pause all activities through Saturday because of a rise in positive cases since the Tigers' regular season finale last weekend against Mississippi State. Since concluding our regular season and conducting four rounds of tests over the last 8 days, we've seen a significant increase in positive COVID-19 tests among our student athletes, coaches, and staff, Sterk said. And after consulting with local health officials, our team physicians, and MU Health's Dr. Steve Witt, who's our representative on the SEC Medical Task Force, we unfortunately must pause all football team-related activities until at least January the 2nd to help contain the virus's spread and ensure the health and well-being of everyone within our program and our community. Missouri players were allowed to go home over Christmas and returned to campus Saturday, something not lost on Iowa players. There's a perception by some, right or wrong, that the Tigers at 5-5, who had a shortage of players at the end of the season, did not necessarily want to play this game despite committing to it. People don't understand that we're used to not seeing our families on holidays, Iowa kicker Keith Duncan tweeted Sunday afternoon. I haven't been with my family for Christmas in 5 years. We stayed in town while they went home. If you didn't want to play in the bowl game, you should have just said so. Missouri coach Eli Drinkwitz said social media posts such as Duncan's were highly unfair, especially to Mizzou players. He said he did not think there should be any blame placed for the cancellation, but would wear it if someone wanted to assign it to someone. Ultimately, it'd be me for being the leader of the organization, Drinkwitz said. I'm careful to pass judgment on anybody, Ferentz said. We had our hardships a week ago. Iowa resumed practice Saturday after pausing all in-person activities for 5 days because of a COVID-19 outbreak of its own. Ferentz was among a group of 6 coaches who tested positive for the virus, while multiple players and other team personnel also were positive. The coach said he went to his team's leadership group Monday night and asked whether it wanted to push forward. Its answer, he said, was a resounding yes, one of the prouder moments of the season for him. Iowa players worked out on their own at local high school fields, Ferentz said, to continue to stay sharp during the 5-day pause. In the last 2 days, wide receivers Emir Smith-Marset and Brandon Smith announced that they were opting out of playing in the bowl to concentrate on the NFL draft. Ferentz said his team would not have been at full strength Wednesday for the game. Turns out there won't be one. Finding a last-minute replacement opponent or pushing back the date of the Music City Bowl were not options. Health and safety remains at the core of every decision this season, and we've always known something like this was a possibility, Iowa Athletics Director Gary Barta said in a statement. I am disappointed for our student-athletes not being able to play in a bowl game, yet so proud of their focus and sacrifice throughout the year. Ferentz said this is certainly one of those years where you don't assume anything is going to happen. You take nothing for granted. I think a healthy thing for all of us to do, and I encouraged our team to do this, is to just take a step back and appreciate what we were able to do. Because back in August, it looked like we weren't going to have an opportunity to do anything. So let's appreciate those 8 games we had together, all the time we've had together. Iowa succeeded despite the always looming coronavirus pandemic and the chaos of the summer when the program underwent an investigation for systemic racial bias. Longtime strength and conditioning coach Chris Doyle was relieved of his duties. We had some pretty good moments to finish on right there, said Ferentz, who continued to display a persistent cough during a Sunday Zoom session with reporters. Winning that Wisconsin game and being in that locker room, if that's where I got the COVID that day, I'll take it. It was worth it. That Saturday, it was worth it. Iowa had the Big Ten's Defensive Player of the Year and Defensive Lineman of the Year in junior tackle Davion Nixon. It is believed Nixon has played himself into being a first-round NFL draft pick, and Ferentz said he has had discussions with Nixon about turning pro. He added he had not had any talks with outstanding sophomore center Tyler Linderbaum about leaving early, and said he did not believe Linderbaum was seriously considering it. All seniors will have the opportunity to come back and play again in 2021, though Smith-Marset, Duncan, and linebacker Nick Neiman are among those who already have publicly said they will move on. Tight end Sean Bauer is scheduled to compete with a combine in January, which is an indication he also will not be back. Ferentz will be back for his 23rd season as Iowa's head coach. I might need an oil change, a 65,000-mile oil change, Ferentz said, but I feel pretty good physically. That is what I like doing. That's probably one other reinforcement of the COVID-19 pandemic era that we've lived through. I'm not quite ready to start stamp collecting or bird watching. Okay, moving on to Dear Abby. Her column today is entitled, Couple Gets on Each Other's Nerves, Dear Abby. I know every relationship is different, but how do you know when to stop trying and let go? My boyfriend and I have been dating for 1.5 years. Lately, all we seem to do is fight or upset each other. I don't want to call it quits, but I'm tired of being angry or sad all the time. We've been trying to fix our relationship for a while now, but nothing seems to stick. We haven't been able to get professional help due to our financial situation and COVID-19, but I don't know what else to do. We've had so much potential for having an amazing life and family in the future that I don't want to give up on what could be just because we can't get along right now. Is love enough to help us through this rough patch? Or am I just fooling myself into thinking we can survive together? And that's signed, Lost in Love in Kansas. Abby responds, Dear Lost, many couples, married and not, have been having relationship problems related to the pandemic and the social isolation it has brought. Add financial issues into the mix, and the result has been anxiety, depression, and disrupted relationships. These are difficult times, and I hope you and your boyfriend can weather the storm by giving each other the gift of patience and understanding. The answer to your dilemma might be as simple as returning to normal once the pandemic gets under control. Here's a story from Shoeyville by Diane Nolan of the Gazette staff. It's entitled, Neighbors Spruce Up Lone Red Cedar for the Holidays. Now we can't cut it down, Jill Reichs said. It has a new life. In a year when a freak inland hurricane on August 10 destroyed so many eastern Iowa trees, a young red cedar hugging Skyview Drive Northeast has been spruced up to not only add some Christmas cheer to a close-knit neighborhood, but to feed the birds and critters. They have already nabbed most of the popcorn strung among the branches and can still snack on birdseed-encrusted pine cones, oranges, and even a dried apricot. The humans who stroll or drive by also can enjoy seeing the festive red and green garland and strings of tiny solar lights that spring to life as the sun sets. It all started with an idea from the kids living and playing in the Brookfield Estates housing development west of Shoeyville, resident Lori Stang said. We have a wonderful neighborhood, and like everybody else, we've been feeling isolated, even from each other, she said. We wanted to create a way for us to stay connected without going into each other's houses, because normally we'd like to have a cookie exchange, then do Christmas carols, sled riding parties, and you can't do that this year. When the kids next door suggested decorating the lonely little tree that planted itself along the roadside, Stang and others sprang into action. Bags of cones from her huge Norway spruce found their way to all 13 houses in the neighborhood, along with an invitation for the kids and residents to smear them with peanut butter or shortening and stick on birdseed, raisins, or granola. It's been such a joy because we have a little Facebook group for the neighborhood, she said, and I think nearly every family has been involved, so we have lots of pictures of grandkids and kids doing their decorations. One of the families said this should become a tradition. On Tuesday, three generations bundled up in winter wear, with a few even sporting antlers, gathered around the tree to admire their handiwork and smiled behind their masks for a group photo. Three-year-old Theo was mesmerized as Mom Kelly Kaufman pointed to the pine cones. Then he was off to hang with the big kids. This is really fun, Stang said, when we can get everybody together. Also from the community page, a story by Diana Nolan, again, of the Gazette staff called Mind Games. Troy Peters describes his journey into magic as taking him from sleight of hand to sleight of mind. He's traded his interest with the cheap plastic props of his youth for mentalism, reading people's thoughts, ideas, and memories, he said. But he still does some smaller magic and will be doing both kinds of mind-blowing wizardry on New Year's Eve during a free all-ages show beginning at 3 p.m. at the Big Grove Brewery and Tap Room in Iowa City. The shows today are more about the audience and their thoughts. It's highly audience centric, he said. Magic is more about fooling people with cards, ropes, silks, but I like performing these Jedi mind tricks on people. The Force may be a little strong with me, but I'm just not an actual Jedi, just a regular geek that likes to have fun with this. That's why I like doing this. There's so many people under so much stress for the past 10 months with COVID. It involves both children and adults, so I think we need some breaks from this weight of that isolation and loneliness. Most of his shows are virtual right now, but he can do smaller in-person shows outdoors when the weather allows, or indoors when health and safety protocols can be put in place, like at the upcoming show at Big Grove. Equipped with a large space in which to keep patrons physically distanced. He's booking a mix of online and in-person shows for small groups, families, corporate, and nonprofit businesses. The events typically last 20 to 45 minutes, and the price range is $125 to $300. "I'm not getting rich off this," he said. "I like to make people laugh. When they do, it really ministers to them. I'm just trying to spread some joy during the holiday season, like a magic Santa, but mainly on Zoom." Now 55 and living with his wife and daughter in Iowa City, his fascination with magic began at age 8, when his parents would take him from their home in Belmont, north of Ames, to Merle Hay Mall in Des Moines. There, young Troy discovered a magic shop, which opened his mind to a new world of possibilities. "I was just wide-eyed whenever I'd go there and get some new tricks," he said. "I just always loved it. There was always something amazing going on there." He especially loved when an elderly clerk would bring some dusty old tricks out of the back room and show them to him. "I was hooked," he said, "kind of like the theater bug, it bit me." When he was a little older, he did some shows for his friends and nieces and nephews. "What's fun now is my nephews are hiring me to do magic shows for their kids," he said, noting that they get the family discount. But as the rest of his life evolved, he set magic aside, sort of. When the pandemic hit, he was an English teacher and drama director at City High in Iowa City. With COVID-19 spiking, however, he and his wife decided he should take the current school year off so he could help their 6-year-old first grader navigate online learning. From the late 1980s to the early 2000s, Peters worked as a props master or set decorator in the art department for TV shows and films in Los Angeles. He lived there for about 10 years and then commuted from Tipton when jobs popped up so he could spend more time at home with his older son. "I always gravitated toward the special effects crew," he said, "learning from them and helping them." Peters worked on about 25 shows, including Pleasantville, L.A. Confidential, and Fight Club. But Catch Me If You Can, directed by Steven Spielberg, and The Bridges of Madison County, starring Clint Eastwood and Meryl Streep, gave him his favorite memories. "I was always in awe when I was speaking with Spielberg. He's trying to tell me something or request something, and all that's going on in my head is, oh my God, it's Steven Spielberg." During Bridges of Madison County, he said Meryl just came into the living room of that farmhouse, spouting Italian, sat on my lap, put her arms around me, kissed me on the cheek, and then just left the room. He rubbed elbows with other high-profile stars. His website, iowacity-magic.com, has a whole section of him posing with other A-listers, such as John Travolta, Michael Douglas, Gary Marshall, Connie Chung, Billy Bob Thornton, Patrick Swayze, Forrest Whitaker, Whoopi Goldberg, Mel Brooks, and Robert Duvall. "They're some fun people," he said, "because they spend 12 hours a day working on these film sets. They want to talk to people. Some of them are actually good people, and some not so." James Earl Jones, that was a highlight as well. "He's just a fantastic man. He would always wonder how my family was back home and ask about that, and ask about my son," Peter said. They were working on the TV show Gabriel's Fire, which aired from 1990 to 1991. Had the stars aligned differently, they might have worked together in Iowa. A University of Iowa alum, Peters interviewed for Field of Dreams while he was still in college. "I didn't get that job," he said, "so I went with this other low-budget film, Zadar, Cal from Hell. It was shot around Iowa City, Solon, Tipton, and Mount Vernon in 1987. So Field of Dreams That was an Oscar-nominated film, and I get Xadar, Cal from Hell, he quipped. However, he recently spotted a Xadar t-shirt on a young female sales clerk in a downtown Iowa City record store. It was probably mine from Goodwill, he added. That movie also was his springboard to Hollywood, when crew members urged him to move there. And when he moved back to Tipton in 1996, he brought a bit of Hollywood with him, starting Tipton's Hardacre Film Festival in 1997. In 2007, he earned a teaching certificate at the University of Iowa and embarked on his teaching career. The following year, he joined the City High faculty. That's where a play rekindled his interest in magic. Just this year, with the pandemic giving him more time to get back to his roots and explore new realms. I was looking at a musical called Matilda. We were going to perform that last spring, he said. It has had some special effects. The main character, Matilda, has some mind-reading powers. Planning some of that effects that we never actually got to do, it got my juices flowing. I started reading and getting into more magic and mentalism. He's not into the dark arts, however. It's all in fun, he said. I don't do seances and raise people's dead ancestors. And here's some New Year's Eve events. First, from Cedar Rapids Public Library, a virtual noon Year's Eve. It's at 11:30 a.m. to noon on Thursday on the library's YouTube channel. You can grab your party hats, noisemakers, and balloons and get ready to count down to noon at home. Chad Elliott will lead viewers in song and celebration, as well as the countdown to the new year at noon at youtube.com/c/Cedar Rapids Public Library. And the Big Grove Brewery and Tap Room at 1225 South Gilbert Street in Iowa City. The Kids Noon Year's Eve from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Table cookie decorating and confetti poppers at noon with a big screen video of the ball drop, face coverings, and social distancing is required. biggrovebrewery.com/Iowa-City-Taproom-Events/Mentalist Troy Peters at 3 p.m., followed by a walk-around magic for the kids, all ages, and it's free. And at Riverside Casino at 3184 Highway 22 in Riverside, New Year's Eve. A guitarist and singer, songwriter, Anna Popovic. It's from 8 to 9:30 p.m. and 10:35 p.m. to 12:05 a.m. at the Show Lounge stage. Ages 21 and over. Cost is $30, and the casino gift shop or riversidecasinoandresort.com/event/2020/DEC/AnnaPopovich.html. And the top weather story for today is entitled Tricky Business of Winter Weather Forecasts. With a potentially strong storm system slugging the Midwest this week, many are asking what we will see in eastern Iowa. But there are still a lot of questions with this system. We use many different computer models to help us forecast the weather. And with this particular storm system, these models show a variety of possibilities. The track of the low-pressure system feeding this storm will play a large role in the type of precipitation we get, and that plays a big role in snowfall totals in the end. If the low tracks to the north, we could see more rain than snow. But if it pushes further south, we could see higher snowfall totals and limited rainfall. And that does it for today's reading of the paper, the Cedar Rapids Gazette, for today, December 28. I'm your reader, Ken Lauder. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website at iowaradioreading.org at any time. And thanks for listening.
From the Bureau of Economic Geology, this is Earth Date. Sometimes we have too much electricity, but more often, grid operators are carefully managing its production to be sure that we have enough. So, a lot of work has gone into trying to store excess electricity to use later when we need it. The obvious solution, giant batteries, is still too expensive for most applications and has environmental implications. This has led scientists to look for other ways. One method uses surplus power to compress air and pump it into old salt mines. The salt tends to seal cracks in the walls, making the mines airtight. When needed, the compressed air can be released to turn a turbine, or it can be used as the intake air for a natural gas power plant, making the plant more productive. Another way to store excess energy is to pump water uphill into existing reservoirs and then release it through hydroelectric dams when power is needed. This method was pioneered 100 years ago in Italy and Switzerland and is used today around the world and in many U.S. states, like Michigan. On the Chilean coast, they're even experimenting with using solar energy to pump seawater up a cliff where it could flow down to make power at night. These solutions don't make economic sense unless the electricity is very cheap and the reservoir was already built for another purpose. But when those two things are present, pumping air and water to store energy plays a valuable role in balancing the grid to meet our ever-changing power demands. For Earth Date, I'm Scott Tinker.
Earth Date is produced by the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin, with support from Schlumberger, helping oil and gas companies increase production and efficiency while lowering environmental impact. You can hear more Earth Date stories at earthdate.org.